Let me give you a real quick postscript on Barclay. Because of this inconsistency in his empiricism, it probably will not surprise you that in his last written work, Cyrus, S-I-R-I-S, published in 1744, Barclay changed his philosophical position. He now held that there's a difference between the perceptions in our mind, the empirical data, if you will, that's present to our minds. There's a difference between them and reality. And he said that the ideas we have of reality are appearances. The real world, he said, consists of God's thoughts. And the world of our ideas or perceptions are simply an image of the truth that transcends the image and about which we only have faint reflections now or flickering reflections. Those of you who have taken ancient philosophy, who does this sound like? Plato. Thank you. You made my day. This is Plato all over again. I have perceptions, but they're only vague reflections of, if you will, faint reminders of the ideas which are God's mind, I mean, to put it in Christian terms. We have only faint reflections of reality in our perceptions, and those are faint reflections of a reality that's beyond our perceptions. You see how he's changed his view? There's a reality beyond our perceptions. Of course, it's not a physical reality. He wasn't going to give up on that. The reality is God's thoughts. Okay, so and this has a lot of parallels, as we've been reminded, to Plato. Okay, questions? I haven't been able to discover why. I'm not sure that it would be hard to find out, but I can't answer it. Yeah. Any other questions about Barclay? Yes.
How do you define the difference between intuitive ideas and innate ideas?
Well, he didn't believe in innate ideas.
Right. So how did he
Okay. Okay. An innate idea is, think about it as an idea that we have upon perceiving anything, having any experience at all, we have to already have an innate idea that helps organize or explain that experience. An innate idea is resident in us. Where Barclay says, one of the perceptions I have, not an innate idea, an idea just sitting there passively waiting, but one of the perceptions I have is a direct perception, therefore an intuition, of myself as a perceiver. So I do have a notion or an intuition, where intuition means it's on the analogy of perception. Okay? The difference is that when I'm perceiving this glass of water sitting here on the podium, that's not direct and internal. There's an idea of the glass of water that I have. But I also have a direct, not indirect, a direct, not perception, because it's internal, so he calls it intuition of myself as a knower. So it's as though he's trying to talk about different kinds of perception. Perceptions that are mediated as ideas and are thought to be external to myself. And then there's the knowing of myself, and that is an intuition or an internal perception, if you will. Now, I'm trying to, you know, to answer your question so that you understand that he was not relying upon innate ideas. I'm trying to be true to Barclay. But in trying to be true to Barclay, you can see how we're all tripped up. Barclay cannot hold on to his empiricism, can he? And add not only that we have perceptions, but now we have intuitions. Now, again, intuitions are not the same as innate ideas, but they certainly are not empirical either. They're at best a model of or an analogy to empirical experience. So thanks for that question. Helpful. Anything else? I know that coming in, Barclay, if you just tell people, hey, to be is to be perceived. Nothing exists independently as a physical object. Everything exists as a perception, and that's all there is. And most people look at that and say, yeah, that's the problem with philosophy, these really weird, stupid, quite contrary to common sense notions. And yet, as strange as his philosophy was, again, Barclay was just trying to be a good empiricist. Remember that. When you run into empiricists who want to say that by their empiricism they know that God doesn't exist, or they know this, they know that, you may want to question them as to whether their empiricism doesn't lead, if they were being logical, to conclusions that they wouldn't like to hold at all. Like, how about Barclay? Everything that exists is a perception or a perceiver. Oh, but I can do one better than that. And this brings me to my favorite philosopher, not because I like him, I have a great deal of antipathy to him, but I like very much the way in which, more than others, he intended to be consistent with his empiricism. When someone is attacking your faith as an empiricist, you might take them not simply to Barclay, but take them all the way. Take them to Hume, David Hume, Scottish skeptic who was born in Edinburgh in 1711 and died in 1776. As a child, Hume briefly passed through a period of piety where he says he worried about his vices, especially the vice of pride. But then later in his life, he realized how childish and foolish that was. He shouldn't have been ashamed of his pride, like Cassius Clay said many years ago, Muhammad Ali. If you can do it, it ain't bragging. But if you have a reason for pride, you shouldn't be ashamed of your pride. The trouble with Christianity, he grew up to see, or he thought, the trouble with Christianity, he thought, was its attempt to extinguish the passions rather than to merely moderate the passions. Now, I want you to remember this little tidbit about the early life of Hume. Because I'm going to maintain that Hume is just a real open and clear example of what's true of all unbelievers. Unbelievers do not begin with evidence against God's existence. They begin with ethical disagreements with what God has said, not liking the ethics of God's revelation. They then proceed to develop a view of reality and knowing that will help justify their own ethical prejudices. You may want to put a star in the margin or something to draw this to your attention again, because I think this is crucial, maybe the one of the most important things you can learn from the history of philosophy, and that's that people do not move impartially, indifferently, objectively, if you will, from a theory of knowledge to the conclusion there is no God. They begin with an ethical axe to grind. They don't like the Christian ethic, though of course they're not going to come out and say that it's really just all a disguised way of getting away from the ethical conclusions that they don't like. They don't like the law of God. They don't like the character of God. Or more importantly, they don't want to admit that they are guilty before God. And so what they do, their whole life is veiled axe grinding. Their whole life is just the disguise of their fleeing from God and the guilt they feel before Him. And David Hume is a sterling example of that. He admits that as a child he felt guilty about his pride, and he later grew up and realized that was foolish. Christianity is the fault here, he said. Christianity tries to extinguish passion. It shouldn't do that. It should simply moderate it. So Hume was a Scottish skeptic who was not as reluctant as Locke or Berkeley to draw the logical conclusions to which empiricism drives us. Locke and Berkeley, I already told you earlier, did not go as far as Hume to skepticism, and the thing that held them back was their Christian convictions. Whatever you may make of Locke, whether he's truly born again, or Berkeley and so forth, and his theology, for whatever criticisms, you have to admit this, they thought of themselves as Christians and they were trying to defend their version of Christianity. And that being the case, that there was something of an anchor against their empiricism going all the way, pulling them all the way into skepticism. But Hume, as I've already told you, he didn't have any sympathy for Christianity, and so he was willing to draw the logical conclusions of empiricism. Of course, let's be empiricist. Where does it take us? Well, in a few moments, we'll see where it takes us, to some radical conclusions that we can't know anything about an external world, can't know anything about an internal world called the self, can't know any causality. Therefore, there's no foundation for laws of science, nor is there any foundation for laws of morality in the objective world. Well, that's quite a lifetime's work, isn't it? To destroy everything that has gone before it in the history of thought. Nothing about the external world, nothing about the internal world, nothing about science, nothing about God or morality can be known. Hey, that's empiricism for you. At the age of 23, Hume went to France and spent 3 years writing his hoped-for great work, A Treatise of Human Nature. This has got to be hard for a boy who's struggling with pride already. At 23, he's going to write his magnum opus. He takes 3 years writing it, and then he couldn't get a publisher to pick it up. And when he finally did find a publisher in 1738, Hume says it, quote, fell dead-born from the press, which means it went nowhere. This thing was dead on arrival. No one was interested in his Treatise of Human Nature. In 1741 and 1742, however, he published separate volumes of essays that were better received than his Treatise of Human Nature. In 1744, he failed to gain the chair of moral philosophy at Edinburgh University. Now, what did I say about Hume? Think about his motivation here. Earlier, he had gone through this period of piety where he felt convicted about pride. Then he thought, oh, that's very foolish. Now in 1744, already being humiliated by his great magnum opus falling dead-born from the press, it turns out that Edinburgh University refuses to grant him the chair of moral philosophy. These Christians at Edinburgh are not going to have him teaching about ethics. I'm telling you, this guy has an axe to grind that has everything to do with what he wanted ethics to be, and had nothing to do, I think, in the end, about what's epistemologically or metaphysically true. So then he served as a paid advisor to the Marquis of Annandale, a man who was recognized to be of wavering sanity, and then Secretary to General St. Clair, who was later the British ambassador to Vienna and Turin. In 1748, Hume revised his dead-born Treatise of Human Nature and now published it that year, part of it as an inquiry concerning the human understanding. An inquiry concerning the human understanding. And then in the next year, 1749, another part of it, an inquiry concerning the principles of morals. Okay, human understanding, epistemology, if you will, and then ethics, an inquiry into morals. In 1751, he moved back to Edinburgh and again failed to gain a professorship there. What do you think? This is going to affect Hume at all and the way he approaches things? Oh, of course. We're dealing with human beings here that don't totally separate their own personal experience from what they think about the world. Yes?
I'm just curious. Did Witherspoon ever run across this rationalism through
Luther?
No, not Luther. Witherspoon.
Oh, Witherspoon. I'd have to do some research. I'm not aware that he did. I do know that the greatest Scottish opponents of Hume were companions of Witherspoon, but I'm not sure if he ever met Hume directly. Okay, in 1751, having failed to gain a professorship at Edinburgh again, he became a librarian in the Advocates' Library. That is the library for the lawyers. 3 years later, he was dismissed by the curators of the library for purchasing obscene books. Of course, he argued that they were not obscene. You know how that always goes. And granted, the obscenities of that day are pale, you know, in comparison to the obscenities of prints and the sorts of things we have today. But nevertheless, again, notice what is the focus of controversy in Hume's life? Morals. He did not get appointed to a chair of moral philosophy. He gets dismissed as a librarian on a morals charge, obscenity. Earlier in his life, it was a moral issue that made him angry about Christianity. Well, while he was the librarian, though, he began his monumental work, one for which he is well known even outside of philosophical circles, A History of England. Hume, in his History of England, argued against the parliamentarians during the Puritan Revolution. He called them pious patriots who cover up their selfish goals with hypocritical theological zeal. Well, once again, I have to ask you, sports fans, does this man look like he is disinterested, objective, puts his feelings aside when he does his philosophy? Man, this guy is angry. At least that's the way it seems to me, because I like these pious patriots that he's putting down. By the way, in the same work, he said that the Reformation was useless, a useless struggle between superstition on the one hand and enthusiasm on the other. And I just want to point out, because you may not be aware of this, this word enthusiasm is a technical term. It doesn't mean just people are real excited about what they believe. It's talking about those who are enthused, filled with God. And so he saw superstition on the one hand, Roman Catholic tradition, over against these mystics, the enthusiasts on the other. Those will be the Protestants. Of course, if Hume had done his homework, he might have realized that John Calvin wrote against enthusiasm as well. Granted, had Hume drawn that distinction, he would have gone on to say, nevertheless, well, as far as he's concerned, Calvin's no better than the enthusiast anyway. But I just want you to see his hostility. Have I made my point here? This man is angry. He doesn't want Christian morality. His life has, you know, not gone the way he wants it to. He can't teach ethics. He's dismissed on an ethics charge. He's really against the Puritan Party and the Reformers. 1763, he became secretary to the British Embassy in Paris, and during this portion of his life, believe it or not, a cult of Hume developed in French intellectual society. I mean, he became the darling of the dilettantes of Paris. In 1766, he then returned to Edinburgh, now as a somewhat famous personality. 1767, he spent 2 years as the undersecretary to General Conway in London. Then in 1769, he returned to Edinburgh, now the center of Scottish literary society. Hey, he was rejected early in his life. Now he's on top of everything. He's the center of attention. Just what a man who struggled early in his life with pride needs, right? But the life of Hume itself is fascinating. Toward the end of his life, James Boswell called on him just a few weeks prior to his death when his health was failing. And Boswell, being a Christian, thought that a discussion of immortality was appropriate. In discussing it with Hume, Hume called the doctrine of everlasting life, I quote, a most unreasonable fancy. He said that if that were true, new universes would need to be created to preserve the trash of every age. Pretty sharp tongue, huh? He says, no, everlasting life isn't true. That's unreasonable because God would have to keep creating universes to be basically the trash bin for all of these souls and the trash of every age. Well, so then Boswell asked him if he entertained any belief in religion, to which Hume replied, just short of his death, that the morality of every religion was bad. Please write that down. I hope I'm making my point here. What is it that he attacks in Christianity and all religion? The morality of every religion, he said, is bad. And indeed, whenever he heard that some man was religious, he concluded that he was a rascal. By the way, in our day and age, the word rascal has kind of playful connotations, even though negative. In Hume's day, to call somebody a rascal was a grave insult. So just remember that. But I quote, whenever he heard that some man was religious, he concluded that he was a rascal. Hume died August 25th, 1776. Just short of 2 months after the signing of the Declaration of Independence in America. Hume's theory of knowledge. Just like the empiricist before him, Hume said he was utterly dissatisfied with the abstruse speculations of the philosophers. And you're sympathetic to that too. And why these guys talk about all this stuff? What are they talking about? It's also senseless. And so he felt, and I quote, the only method of freeing learning at once from these abstruse questions is to inquire seriously into the nature of human understanding. End of quote. I want you to begin to note, not only in the philosophers we've recently been studying, but from Hume and others that I'm going to be mentioning, how often philosophy in this period of time focuses on the nature of the mind, the nature of the knowing process. Human understanding. And Hume takes the same approach. But he wants to reformulate the position of Locke. Remember how Locke distinguished between different kinds of ideas, external, internal, simple, complex, so forth. The distinction that Hume proposed is one between impressions and ideas. Impressions and ideas. This is frustrating, especially to students that are just beginning philosophy. Well, it's frustrating to the rest of us, too. But these empiricists use their vocabulary in different ways. You see, Hume uses the notion of an idea differently than Berkeley, and the two of them differently than Locke, and on and on and on. For him, idea stands over against impression. What's the difference? He said the degree of vivacity. Impressions are very vivacious, very lively perceptions, whereas ideas are less vivacious. Ideas are when we reflect on our sensations. According to Hume, and I quote him, all the materials of thinking are derived either from our outward or our inward sentiment. The mixture and composition of these belongs alone to the mind and will. Or, to express myself in philosophical language, all our ideas or more feeble perceptions are copies of our impressions or more lively ones. Okay? So what's in the mind for Hume? You have real vivacious impressions, and then you have copies, or if you will, not so lively ideas of those impressions. Therefore, anything that's in the mind and is going to be meaningful must be traced back in some way to perception or to an impression. According to him, our ideas, our thoughts, resolve themselves into such simple ideas as were copied from a precedent feeling or sentiment. Okay, if that's his analysis of the mind, and I'm being very brief with it, if that's his analysis of the mind, we have impressions, we have ideas. Ideas are copies of impressions. Impressions are more lively, vivacious perceptions. Then it won't surprise you, get this in your notes, he says, when we entertain, therefore, any suspicion that a philosophical term is employed without any meaning or idea, as is but too frequent, we need but inquire from what impression is that supposed idea derived. This is what we call the empirical criterion of meaning. Yes, the empirical criterion of meaning. Oh, you want me to define the empirical criterion of meaning? Sure. When we entertain any suspicion that a philosophical term is employed without any meaning or idea, we need to inquire from what impression is that supposed idea derived. Okay, you don't have to say this quote-unquote, but what he says is, philosophers talk about all this fancy schmancy stuff, okay? And when you suspect maybe those terms or that term is meaningless, the test of its meaningfulness is, can you trace it back to an idea and from an idea to an impression originally? Every meaningful term, therefore, must trace back to a sense perception. This is what's known as the empirical criterion of meaning. So let's stop right here. What do you make of the empirical criterion of meaning? Hume says if you have a suspicion about any philosophical proposal, it's only meaningful if you can trace it back to sense perception ultimately. So let's ask whether Hume's philosophical idea passes its own test. Have we ever perceived that meaning, that anything that's meaningful must be based in perception? Is that one of the perceptions we've had? Y'all see what I'm getting at? What Hume was saying here turned his own philosophy into meaninglessness, because he couldn't live up to the empirical criterion of meaning. The empirical criterion is itself not empirical. If you put that in your notes, maybe that'll help you remember this. The empirical criterion is itself not empirical. The statement of Hume's philosophy at this point does not itself trace back to sensation, to perception. You should note another problem with Hume's empiricism, and that's a major assumption that was also made by Locke, that every item in our consciousness, every impression, every idea, must be a distinct, separate, isolated unit. What I have called earlier psychological atomism. Is that true to experience? Is everything in our mind nothing more but a simple or a compounded set of perceptions? No, as I told you yesterday, if you stop and think about it, the idea of a separate quality or perception is itself an abstraction from the way we really observe the world. My observation of the world, taking this book as my illustration again, is not of a compounding of orange paper and binding and other things. I rather see a book, okay, or I might say an orange-colored book. And then I can stop and say, oh yeah, well, I can think about the color and I can think about the paper and the binding and other things separately. Whereas Hume assumes that what we have are all these separate perceptions that get somehow brought together. Well, how do these ideas get associated then? Our ideas fall into regular patterns, even as Berkeley had observed. And they don't seem to be random or chance. And so Hume said there must be some universal principles at work among our ideas, something that binds them together, some associating quality. Why is it that I have, you know, binding page, color, size, and so forth? What brings all these ideas together? And according to him, there are three such principles: the principle of resemblance, the principle of contiguity. Contiguity means being side by side. And thirdly, the principle of cause and effect. Because Hume had an empirical criterion of meaning, anything meaningful must trace back to sense perception, and because he held to psychological atomism, that all of our impressions are, if you will, particular in their nature, then it won't surprise you that Hume was a nominalist. He didn't believe in anything beyond particulars or individuals. And so Hume is proposing to put together a philosophy that gets by without universals at all. There are no universals, there are only particular perceptions and faint copies of them, and then the compounding of those perceptions or ideas by means of resemblance, contiguity, cause and effect. Hume is a nominalist, but there has never been a nominalist as viciously consistent as Hume. There were nominalists in the Middle Ages, but of course they also believed in God and the will of God being active in the world. Hobbes had been a nominalist, but Hobbes was not so much interested in the epistemological question, and he eventually wanted to make political application and to solve problems by appeal to the will of the Leviathan. Locke and Berkeley had been interested in epistemological questions, but they inconsistently allowed themselves universals of a certain sort as spiritual activity or spiritual causes. Remember, as I said, because they were Christians. So they couldn't go all the way with their nominalism. And so that's why Hume is so important. He doesn't have the God of the Middle Ages. He doesn't have the Leviathan of Hobbes. He doesn't have the inconsistent Christianity of Locke and Berkeley to hold him back. He is going to be a thoroughgoing nominalist and draw the implications of his empirical starting point. According to Hume, traditional philosophy, much that had been held by most people to be true and indeed important for life, traditional philosophy, he says, is not simply false, it makes no sense at all. It is nonsensical. When I was lecturing on Berkeley, I already told you what Hume was going to do, and I'll remind you now. Berkeley wanted to be more consistent than Locke, and so he gave up Locke's material bodies. Hume said, I can be more consistent than Berkeley. We have to give up spiritual substances as well. The logic of empiricism destroys not only the outward world of extension in space, physical bodies, it destroys any continuing inward world of selfhood or spirit as well. And so let's look at the notion of substance real quickly. We've done this so many times that I'll just mention it in passing. Hume says we got to trace everything back to sensation, right? If it's going to be meaningful. Do you have a sensation of substance, the unperceived substratum of the qualities you perceive? Nope, no one does that. Substance now is gone. Your head will be spinning by the time we finish this. So one major philosophical notion, meaningless, gone. How about the self? The idea that there's a continuing personal perceiver of these perceptions out there. Hume says, from what impression could this idea be derived? And I quote him, self or person is not any one impression, but that to which our several impressions and ideas are supposed to have reference. And I quote him again, I never can catch myself at any time without a perception. Okay? I perceive a lot of things in this world. Do I perceive selfhood? Nope. He says, at best, what I have is a bundle or collection of different perceptions. The self, therefore, is not in the traditional sense a continuing identity or spiritual substance. The self is just the collection of perceptions. And although I don't hear you moaning and groaning and writhing in pain, from a philosophical standpoint, this is very painful. What Hume is doing is he's destroying everything we take for granted. Let's be empirical. Do we have any sensation of the self? No. We only have sensations. And when we add a sensation to a sensation to a sensation, when they're put into a bundle, that's what we are. We don't perceive the perceiver, we only have the perceptions. Remember the psychological atomism that I spoke of? You see, in Hume's world, everything is disjointed. There's no unity. Everything is just a separate perception. So there can't be a self that has the perceptions. There can just be a bundle of perceptions. Well, let's move on to a maybe more abstract, but a very important philosophical concept. What about the concept of identity? Do we ever have a sensation of identity? Again, those of you who are new to this, pay attention because I know it sounds strange, but it's really not that hard. Is there an identity to this eraser? You think so, eh? What makes you think so? Have you perceived an identity? What have you perceived? Well, you have certain sensations that this eraser is bringing to you, right? Now, you're having a sensation right now of the eraser, T1. Now you're having a sensation of the eraser, T2. Now you're having a sensation of the eraser, T3. Now you're having a sensation of the eraser, T4. Now I've gone slower than I have to. I mean, I can go T1, T2, you know, real fast. But the point is, you're having sensation, 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 sensation. Let me ask you this. Are you also having a sensation of identity between T1, T2, T3, T4? No, everything's loose and discrete. And so Hume says, all you have is a momentary sensation. And what connects moment to moment to moment? Nothing. You cannot empirically prove the identity of this eraser. Or to use a more high-flown illustration, can you prove your own personal identity? Okay, we take out a picture from your high school yearbook. We say, is this you? You say, yep, that's me, just a few years ago, just last year, whatever. I say, well, how do you know that you're identical with the person in this picture? Well, because it's the same person. Now, that's what I'm asking. How do you know it's the same person? Do you perceive an identity between the person in the picture and the person you see in the mirror? Do you? No, be an empiricist. You don't see any identity. You see this and you see that. This and that. Just like you see this and you see this and you see this eraser, but you don't see anything that binds the three perceptions or 3,000 perceptions of the eraser. Look at how Hume is destroying the philosophical landscape. Substance is gone. Self is gone. The very basic notion of identity is now gone as meaningless. All we have is a succession of different objects, a succession of different perceptions. We don't have any perception of uninterrupted identity between them. The idea of identity does not refer to some particular impression. And so identity cannot be a property of objects. Identity is only a property of our minds. Our minds imagine a union between the perception of the eraser at T1, perception of the eraser at T2, perception of the eraser at T3. Our minds contribute the identity by imagination. There's no identity out here in the object that you perceive. Well, then what about the external world? We've gotten rid of substance, self, identity. You think there can be an external world on this philosophy? There it goes too. Now, does that mean that Hume didn't believe in an external world? Let's be careful, because Hume's point is simply to show that you cannot justify a belief in the external world. And I quote him, "The mind has never anything present to it but the perceptions, and cannot possibly reach any experience of their connection with objects. The supposition of such a connection is therefore without any foundation in reasoning." This is Berkeley all over again, okay? What is present to my mind? A perception. Now, I think that perception is connected to an object out there, right? That I have an idea of the object out there. But do I see any connection between the two? No, all I see is the idea, or in this case, the impression. And so what Hume has shown is, I have no way to justify an external world either. Will? Well, identity must be more than a collection. It must be uninterrupted connection. And you don't see the uninterrupted connection. You just have one perception, like that, in succession. But you don't know that there is an uninterrupted connection between them. You don't perceive a connection. That's right. You only perceive the perception. All you have is an impression, and an impression, and an impression. But you don't see any connection between the impressions, and therefore there's no identity.
I mean the connection of the perception and the fact that the apple, red, and brown, those are two perceptions.
Yeah, but you don't see any connection between those two. Those just happen to be ideas that are in your mind at the same time. Okay. Again, I told you, I prepared you for this by saying Hume is a viciously consistent empiricist. If the only thing that has meaning is what I perceive or what I have an impression of, I don't have an impression of connection between qualities. I don't have an impression of a self. I don't have an impression of identity or of substance. Nor do I have any impression of an external world. I do have impressions that I think are of an external world, but I don't perceive, I don't have any impression of a connection. Let's go back to the old thing. The mind knows ideas of the world. Hume says, I don't see any connection between the idea and the world. All I see is the idea or the impression. What is meant by an external world? What is meant by an external world is an existence distinct from the mind and perception. But since I only know my perceptions, I have no basis for believing in the continued distinct existence of a world beyond my perceptions. Why then do people believe in an external world? According to Hume, we have within ourselves a faculty of imagination. And that imagination produces the notion not only of identity, but also of externality. And so we are, in a sense, pretending that there is a connection between perceptions so that there's identity in the eraser. We are pretending that there's a connection between my perception and an object beyond it. But we know that we don't really perceive any of those things. We have, if you will, a psychological habit of using our imagination to draw a connection between our perceptions. But it's only a psychological habit, Pete.
Would you say there could be a plurality of particulars? Like if you had two erasers, you could make a connection between one eraser and the other eraser.
Well, he would say you have a perception of one eraser next to another eraser. Contiguity. They're side by side.
So there would be two erasers.
So there would be two erasers. But that would only be an impression of two erasers. Okay. So, that we not misunderstand Hume, remember that he thinks that there is a regularity in our perceptions. And because of that regularity, it's the mind which imaginatively, the mind has this tendency imaginatively to pass from one perception to another without taking account of the intervals, the break between perceptions. The mind fills in the blanks, if you will, between idea and object, between moment one, moment two, moment three. So what is the basis for our belief in material objects and an external world? This is what you want to get into your notes. For Hume, the basis of our belief in an external world of material objects is not philosophical or logical. It is psychological. The reason why we believe in an external world of physical objects is because of an empirically verifiable property of our imagination. That is, we experience ourselves filling the gap bridging the gap in all these cases. And we note that this is a natural propensity of our minds. But what he's doing here is not analysis of the world. He's doing analysis of what? My psychology, of my internal mental behavior. And what arises from this then is a tension in Hume's thinking between our instinctual beliefs and what reason can justify. We have a psychological instinct to bridge those gaps so that there's identity between moment one, moment two, moment three of the eraser. We have an instinctual tendency to bridge the gap between impressions and what they're impressions of objects outside ourselves. But it's only instinctual. There is no basis in reason to believe these things. And this brings us to the biggest of all of Hume's destructive, the most major thing that of which he was destructive, the notion of causality. What has Hume destroyed so far? Substance, self, identity, external world. And now, he says, you stop and think about it, we don't have any empirical justification to believe in causality. In the empirical sciences, you'll note that we constantly argue from some cases to all cases, or at least to probably all cases. Let's go back to the water, the salt, and the dissolving. Okay? Now, I've had some experiences of salt dissolving in water. Which is to say, because everything is unconnected, I have an impression of salt, an impression of it being in water, and an impression of dissolving. Now, most of you, just because you follow your instincts rather than being critical thinkers, most of you would say, well, the water dissolved the salt. The water caused the salt to dissolve. Hume would say, but what can you justify empirically? You can only justify this combination, water, salt, dissolving. Somebody says, well, I saw water, salt dissolving yesterday, and I noticed that water, salt dissolving today is also the case. I have impressions. Those go together. In fact, I could put together, let's say, 100 instances like that where I have this combination, water, salt dissolving. Would I have proved that the water dissolved the salt just because I have a number of past experiences of those three things going together? Yeah, be critically minded here. Hume says you have no way of knowing that there's a connection to the future, that in the future, water, salt, and dissolving will go together. For all you know, tomorrow it'll be water, salt, and no dissolving. Now somebody's going to say, oh no, wait a minute. It was like that in the past. It must be like that in the future. And this is where Hume moves in for the kill. Boom! Must? Have you ever had a sense impression of must? No. Facts are just what they are. And you can't say what the facts will be tomorrow on the basis of what they were previously. Or to put it this way, Hume says we have the habit of seeing these three things together. And the habit just comes because so often in the past you've had water, salt, and dissolving go together. That is a habit of mind. But there is no necessary connection. The fact that some cases are water, salt, and dissolving cases doesn't prove that all cases of water and salt will be dissolving cases. You can't prove from some experiences what will be true in all experience. There is, to put it a different way, no necessary connection between dissolving and the impressions of water and salt. And I quote him, "There is not in any single particular instance of cause and effect anything which can suggest the idea of necessary connection. I see the water, I see the salt, I see the dissolving, I do not see, observe, perceive necessary connection." Yes, sir. This is this question, what's his concept of time, takes us beyond what I'm lecturing on right now, but I want you to feel good about yourself. Later philosophers who are phenomenologists are going to have that kind of critical approach to the skepticism of a Hume, because it turns out that you've got to have some concept of time as a framework within which you can say these are discrete instances. In the same way, this is a more sophisticated, which you just brought up, more sophisticated point, but that's similar to Dr. Bahnsen saying, the empiricist took it for granted we have these atomistic perceptions. But it turns out, phenomenologically, in terms of our true experience of the world, we don't have separate perceptions. We know objects. So there's something in us that perceives the world as objects in time. Okay? And now, to make you feel even better, when Immanuel Kant got around to trying to refute David Hume, this is exactly the approach he took. He said Hume cannot make sense of what he's saying unless the mind itself is doing something to organize or set up the way in which we receive the senses of the world. And time and space are two major modes of perception. Okay? So thanks for the question. If all of you didn't appreciate where that was going, we'll pick it up as we go along. Back to Hume. And I quote at length, "It appears that in single instances of the operation of bodies, we never can, by our utmost scrutiny, discover anything but one event following another, without being able to comprehend any force or power by which the cause operates, or any connection between it and its supposed effect. The same difficulty occurs in contemplating the operations of mind on body, where we observe the motion of the latter to follow upon the volition of the former, but are not able to observe or conceive the tie which binds together the motion and the volition, or the energy by which the mind produces this effect." And aside, okay, I think I'm picking up the glass here, right? Well, what I perceive is my thought or willing of picking up the glass. Then there's another event, the glass being raised by my hand. But do I perceive any connection between my willing and the glass being raised by the hand? No. It's just a succession of events. "The authority of the will over its own faculties and ideas is not a whit more comprehensible, so that upon the whole, there appears not throughout all nature any one instance of connection which is conceivable by us. All events seem entirely loose and separate. One event follows another, but we never can observe any tie between them." Now, I don't like to dictate notes to people, but this one short or two lines here, I would like you to write down in your notes. This is a quote from Hume. "All events seem entirely loose and separate. One event follows another, but we never can observe any tie between them." Because I'm dictating, I'll repeat it one more time, not wishing to bore you, but I know you want to get it down right. "All events seem entirely loose and separate. One event follows another, but we never can observe any tie between them." He goes on to say, "They seem conjoined, but never connected." Conjoined means they're contiguous. We have this event, side by side with this event, but we never see a connection between them. So let's go to our billiard ball metaphor or illustration. Hume says, here's one event that I perceive. The man with the cue stick, you know, here's this event. He pushes the cue stick forward. I see another event, the white ball going across the table. I see another ball, another event, the white ball stopping right at what appears to be the surface of the black ball. I see another event, the black ball going across the table in the opposite direction of the man with the cue stick. So I see all these events, or if you will, all these events are contiguous. They're next to each other. Event one, event two, event three, event four. He says, but in all of that, I see no connection between the events. And since I see no connection, no necessary connection, there is no cause and effect. I can't prove causality. Somebody says, well, but in every case in the past where you had event next to event two, next to event three, next to event four, so in the future, event one, two, three, and four are going to be contiguous. But he's already refuted that, right? I have no knowledge of what the future is going to be like. I have no knowledge of necessary connection, and I have no knowledge of future association of impressions, and therefore there's no way to prove causality. And yet, Hume didn't want to dismiss the notion of necessary connection as meaningless. Well, then what are we talking about when we say there's a necessary connection? Hume said there's no necessary connection out there in the world. The necessary connection is supplied by what? My mind. I imagine that there's a connection because I'm in the habit of expecting 1, 2, and 3 to be followed by 4. Okay? I'm in the habit, from past experience, of expecting cue stick thrust forward, white ball moving, white ball stopping at black ball, to be followed by number 4, black ball going across the table. I have this habit. But what you have to understand then, that causality does not have a rational foundation. Causality is just a psychological habit. And thus, all of science, which rests upon the causal principle, rests upon psychology, not rationality. Yes?
If causality is only divided through the mind and not out in the world, then does he say that there is no God in order to make cause and effect in the world?
Bingo. Hume is not going to be impressed with the cosmological argument for God's existence, which says, here are all these cause-effect relationships, and that must take us back to a first cause, because Hume says there aren't any causes in the world to begin with, much less a first cause of the world as a whole. So we're going to get to his religious convictions in a few minutes, but you've anticipated very, very well. I'm very happy. My students are making my day over and over again today. According to Hume, then, the sciences are really limited to historical statements. They can only report past observations.